Welcome to the American Maritime Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Roberts. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to the American Maritime Partnership for sponsoring this podcast. I've really been looking forward to today's discussion. It is focused on China's maritime strategy and how it relates to U.S. maritime policy generally, and the Jones Act in particular. This is certainly a timely subject as we continue to work through how America can best respond to China's global ambitions. Not very much attention has been paid to the maritime part of the story, and that gives us the opportunity today to do that. And I'm delighted to be joined today by John Kaskin of the Navy League. John is a true expert on U.S. maritime capabilities on both the military and commercial side of things. He held a key strategic role at the Pentagon for several years, focused on U.S. shipbuilding and sea lift capabilities, among other things. He also leads a group of experts that get together to really discuss new developments that meets monthly. They're really thought leadership in the maritime industry. So, John, it's great to be with you today and really look forward to our discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, and thank you for having me here today. This is a subject which is dear to my heart. In my capacity as the co-chair for the Marine Affairs Committee of the Navy League, I'm basically the proponent for that sea service amongst the four. And I assure you that we do make the maritime industry as equal or even greater than the other three, the Navy, Marine Corps, the Coast Guard.
That's great. Well, we really appreciate it. So let's get to it. We're going to talk about the report just issued by the Navy League. The title of the report says a lot, that, quote, China's use of maritime for global power demands a strong commitment to American maritime. So there's an assertion and a conclusion in there. It's very useful, I think. So the report was issued about a week ago, and I would encourage everyone to find the Navy League on the web and take a look at the report. It's been picked up by numerous media outlets, including Newsweek. And I understand, John, that you were the Navy League lead on this report. And before we get any further, I want to thank you and the Navy League for this important work.
Well, again, thank you, Mike. I really was just an editor of the report. I contributed amongst many others. Daisy Ridgway was the primary author. Sarah Fuentes and Ryan Simon from the Navy League, and Sarah, who is still a strong member of Navy League, all contributed to it. And I think we generated a very useful product, and I'm glad to see that it is getting the publicity that it has, because I think it's an important issue.
It is. I agree. Thank you. So let me frame the discussion and to sort of help our listeners. It might be helpful if you could take a minute or two to just summarize U.S. policy concerning the commercial maritime industry and how that has worked out.
Well, thanks, Mike. I'm going to spend a minute reading what is the policy, because it is from the Merchant Act of 1936, and it hasn't changed. And essentially says it's a policy of the United States to encourage and aid the development and maintenance of a merchant marine necessary for the national defense and the development of domestic and foreign commerce. And the objectives are to have a merchant marine that is sufficient to carry the waterborne commerce, which is the Jones Act, 100%, and a substantial part of the waterborne export and import foreign commerce of the United States, and to provide shipping service essential for maintaining the flow of waterborne commerce and foreign and domestic at all times. It's also to be capable of serving as a naval and military auxiliary in time of war or national emergency. It needs to be owned and operated as vessels of the United States by citizens of the United States. It needs to be composed of the best equipped, safest, and most suitable types of vessels constructed in the United States, and manned and trained with an efficient citizen personnel. And it's to be supplemented by efficient facilities for building and repairing vessels. So how are we doing against that? Well, for the domestic commerce, we're fulfilling the intent of that act. That's the Jones Act from 1920, which we're celebrating its 100th anniversary, even though the cabotage laws of that type have been here from the beginning of our country. The international commerce part of it, we've got about 86 ships in international commerce, of which 60 are receiving a stipend to fly the U.S. flag. And of the rest, about half of them are on charter to the government. I wouldn't give that such a good grade. With respect to shipbuilding, we had around 20 shipyards capable of building ocean-going ships. At the end of the Cold War, we're down to eight, only four of which only doing Navy work. So there's issues there, although certainly there's a lot of the small and medium yards that are supporting the Jones Act shipping. And we don't have, and with respect to the Merchant Marine, they're well trained at the federal and state maritime academies, as well as the Maritime Union schools and other facilities. But we're 1,800 short if we wanted to crew up the reserve fleets in a protracted wartime operation. So we have an insufficiency of overall crew mariners for wartime operations. So that's really where we are today with respect to what the policy is and how well it's been implemented from my perspective.
Thanks for that. I think the challenges that the U.S. shipyards have and the especially, of course, in international trades certainly have led us to a point where we're relatively not very significant in those markets. And it does sort of the change in the China policy certainly cries out for us to relook at that policy. Let me ask you, is there a connection, and you alluded to this, but is there a connection in your view between our commercial maritime industry and our national security?
In multiple aspects of it. The one that I was most involved in the Pentagon was strategic sea lift. Under the auspices of the U.S. Transportation Command and the Joint Staff and OSD, we would determine what were the sea lift, airlift, and land lift capabilities required to support major contingencies. When I first was in the Pentagon, we focused on Iraq and then South Korea. Now the world has changed, and we're looking at completely different scenarios, the contested environments and operations if we had to go to support our NATO allies in Europe, if there were any Russian aggression that went across the red line, and as well as in the Pacific, where China emerged as a peer competitor. The war plans necessary to support, to determine the lift that's required hasn't been fully analyzed yet. The Congress has been asking for a mobility capabilities and requirements study for the last couple of years, but because these war plans have been under development, we still don't know what is the requirement for strategic lift and whether we have deficiencies. Although we do have one that everybody has identified even without that analysis in tankers, and we can talk about that a little bit later. So that aspect of the of what we need for national security is under development. What we have today was good for supporting major contingencies in other areas, and that we're not under a contested environment. Right now, we're concerned about even from the ports of embarkation that there could be sabotage there. There could be interdiction across the Pacific or the Atlantic, and of course at the ports of debarkation. This is a completely different game, and we may need more lift to take into account attrition. But there is also the security of the nation on which the Jones Act provides, which is to ensure that we're able to move our goods and services to our industrial facilities, as well as for our imports and exports. And if we don't maintain our domestic waterways, those lines of communications could be cut off, and we cannot fight a war if our economy is brought to its knees.
John, you mentioned the China and China's maritime policy. There's been a lot of attention in the last year on China's maritime activities. There was a hearing in the House Coast Guard Subcommittee on this. There have been studies and briefs by leading think tanks in Washington. And of course, the Navy League report that you helped lead builds on this work, and in some respects really connects the dots, in my view. Could you summarize what China has been up to when it comes to its maritime industry?
Well, I think what China has done is, as well as it's done in a lot of other areas, it's copied what we have done in the past. And if we look at how we became a major power, it was under the auspices of the policies of Admiral Alfred Mahan Thayer, which said for a country to become wealthy, it must have a strong merchant marine to support its commerce. Its trade in commerce was what brought wealth to a country, and that you needed a navy to be able to ensure that those lines of communications are maintained, and you needed to have diplomacy as a means to ensuring that that was going to happen, backed up with the military. And I think that's exactly what the Chinese are doing, which is what you would expect a country that's trying to become a great power to do. The issue is that they don't want to play by the same rules as everybody else did as they rose and became great powers. They wanted to change the world order and not follow those rules. So they want to say, hey, listen, the South China Sea, there's a nine dash lines that was something that's a couple hundred years old that said this was traditional area that we had controlled when we were the Middle Kingdom. We need to regain that stature. And therefore, all of the resources and trade that goes within that region should be under our auspices. So they built these coral reefs into islands in order to provide the military support, and they had to support operations if they needed to defend their area of interest. They've tried to put air defense zones in that area and require countries to report when they're in that area. They have taken over islands and that are contested, and the international court says they should not have ownership of in the Philippines, and so on. So they're basically attempting to regain their stature in that they had in the past, which means that they want to have control of their trade within the area. In order to do that, and they want not only to have the merchant marine and the shipbuilding industry to support it, they also want to ensure that the ports around the world will accept their goods. So they have, through the Belt and Road Initiative, developed infrastructure, not only seaborne, but also landborne infrastructure, to ensure that their lines of communications and their trade cannot be impeded by countries that they think may become inimical to them if the world doesn't agree with their idea of what the world order should be versus the ones that we have lived successfully by and that has helped generate their wealth since the end of World War II.
One area that the reports dig into a little bit, and particularly the CSIS report, concerns government support for commercial shipbuilding and ship operations in China. The report indicates there's the supports totaled $132 billion over a 10-year period between 2008 and 2017, I think are the right dates, but it's roughly $15 billion a year in support by the Chinese government to the Chinese commercial shipbuilding and ship operations industry. And how does that compare with U.S. maritime policy and U.S. maritime government maritime support for the commercial maritime industry?
Well, as I alluded to, we have been playing by what we wanted is a level playing field with the rest of the world. So we have not subsidized our shipbuilding industry or our shipping industry or our port industry in the same way because we're following the rules that our European allies and our other Asian friends have followed. And so when you do that, you don't necessarily need to own and have the capability of all the shipping that comes to your country. You don't need to own all the ports around the world in order to do that if everybody's following the same rules. But the Chinese have decided that through the use of their state-owned enterprises and through the support that you talked about, as well as through financing, that they want to build up various elements of the industry. In certain cases, they considered it strategic. Shipbuilding is the perfect example. They have decided that steel and shipbuilding industries heavy industries are critical for their ability to become the number one economic nation in the world. And so they have built hundreds of shipyards, whether they're economic or not, in order to generate ships at costs that nobody really knows what they are because of the various indirect and direct subsidies, financing vehicles that are also in our report, so that they can underprice any other country in the world. And right now, they're number one in shipbuilding. Korea is number two, Japan is number three. They make up 90%, but China is doing its best to put the other two out of business. And if that's the case, then right now, the European Union is very concerned that their shipbuilding industry is going to collapse, particularly if the Chinese go into cruise construction. So they are not playing by the same level playing field. Then the question is, what is the impact and what do we need to do to address that? And is it of economic or national defense concern to us?
I want to get to that. The net result of the China's maritime policy and the supports that it provides to its industry as compared to U.S. maritime policy is that there are thousands of Chinese-built ships operated in the world by Chinese companies and others. And those that are operated by Chinese companies are ultimately subject to government control, the Chinese Communist Party, to some degree. Compare that to U.S., where we have maybe 100 large commercial ships built in U.S. yards over the past decade. Less than 100 ships flying the U.S. flag at this point in international trades. And those that are there because we have programs to enable that. And that's not a prediction of where we might end up. It's a picture of the reality of where we are today. So why does that matter? Why should people be concerned about that?
It's the issue of will the Chinese growth get to a point in any area where it could compromise our supply chains. The COVID crisis has shown that there are certain areas today where the supply chains can be interdicted, whether it's pharmaceuticals or strategic materials. And the nation is beginning to react to that in trying to develop policies associated with it. So the question being, are we getting to the same situation with respect to shipbuilding and shipping? With respect to those industries, the question is, what is it that we need to be able to ensure that we have the capability that is necessary to be able to not have our supply chains interdicted? Do we need to develop better relations or closer relations with our allies and partners to ensure that there is sufficient shipping to be able to support our economy? We don't necessarily have to have it under our flag. We have to have the ability to be able to gain access to it. Again, there's less than 2% of our trade currently is on U.S. flag ships, international trade. And we haven't had any issues with that. The question is, can the Chinese get to the point where they could either interdict that or to increase pricing, which is one of the reasons why the Jones Act was established in the first place after the end of World War I. There needs to be some analysis on that. And it's, again, but with respect to shipbuilding, which is a strategic industry, and it is one where we have a very small number of shipyards in this country, we need to figure out how to maintain that capability and capacity and the labor associated with it. With the 40,000 vessels that are in the inland waterways and the small shipyards that support it, at least that is an industry that can that helps keep up the expertise and skill set, because a welder in a small shipyard can go into a welder into a Navy shipyard or one that can build Navy and commercial construction. But we certainly don't want to do what happened in Canada. Their cabotage law doesn't require Canadian-built ships. And they ended up having no shipyards available to build their Canadian Navy or their Coast Guard ships. And they've spent billions of dollars resurrecting that industry. The Brits had to go to Korea to get their oilers built. I mean, we really don't need want to be in that type of position. So we have to ensure that we maintain what's the minimum necessary, because there are a lot of other strategic areas that we have identified we're going to have to make investments in, as well as this one.
Very interesting. So even short of getting into a shooting war, which we hope never happens, and I think Americans are skeptical that it would happen, but even short of that, China's dominance, potential dominance in the global maritime industry, has ramifications that are just not in our best interest, potentially at least, right?
Well, certainly. I mean, they haven't impacted us directly, but they're impacting our friends and our allies in Asia. I mean, there is something that most people don't even realize exists called their naval militia. I mean, they have hundreds of, quote, fishing vessels that are definitely fishing vessels, but they're not used for fishing. And they're used to intimidate the Vietnamese when they want to go do offshore oil exploration. They've been intimidating the Philippines on trying to maintain their bases on their islands. And as they continue to do that, and if there is no action to be able to provide a counterforce to that, then they will continue to spread that type of intimidation further and further, so that they can get back to the period of the Middle Kingdom, where everybody it becomes a tributary nation under their control. Ultimately, in order for them to do that, they want us out of the Pacific, and that's really what their main objective is that we're just an impediment against them for achieving that objective.
So how should America respond? We're very so far behind in terms of commercial shipbuilding, U.S. flag operations. What should our response be to the Chinese policies in this area?
Well, I mean, we have to do it asymmetrically. We're not going to build a merchant marine of several thousand ocean-going ships. And we're not going to build 100 shipyards to try to compete them doing that. But what we need to do is to build alliances and partnerships with the countries in Asia and around the periphery, that the places where the Belt and Road Initiative has been the strongest, we need to also, with our partners, whether it is Japan, whether it's Korea, whether it's Australia, Singapore or whatever other, to build up our own network of capabilities to ensure that everybody feels comfortable that they can operate under the current rule of order without having to submit to the one that the Chinese are offering. So it's going to have to be done diplomatically. It's going to have to be done through economic activity. And of course, we need to still maintain a sufficient military capability as a deterrent, so that they just don't decide that, hey, listen, we'll just take if we don't get what we want. And you know, that's the same situation that we're trying to do in Europe as well. So we have to maintain that deterrent capability in conjunction with our allies.
So bringing it back home, back to our domestic markets, I assume we obviously need to hold on to what we have from a maritime perspective, Jones Act, MSP, and so on. And that's not enough, as we've talked about, but it's a start, it seems to me. Are there other, and if you don't agree with that, please let me know, but are there ways we should be playing offense in terms of building our maritime capabilities?
Well, certainly. We've got to maintain what we've got. It was a very positive development when we now have both candidates for the presidency that are strongly supporting the Jones Act. So I think that we need to maintain that. There are still think tanks, conservative think tanks, that only look at the Jones Act as from an economic perspective. They just think it's an interference in the marketplace and it should be like all other interferences removed. They don't take into account the public's good that the Jones Act provides, which is economic and national security. And that argument, I think, is winning out right now, and we need to maintain that, because that is the foundation from which to build. Now, for international trade, you know, there are various proposals. The question is, how much resources are we willing to invest in it? If the mobility capabilities requirement study indicates that we need more types of vessels and more of the same capacity, then that will be a growth factor. One area that for sure is where we're going to need growth is in the tanker arena. The concern that I didn't mention before is that even though the Chinese may not own all the tankers in the world and not give us access to them, they can intimidate countries that do own tankers that say, hey, listen, if you support the U.S. government in this operation, you know, you're not going to be able to trade with us. They'll do economic blackmail like what they did with South Korea when we put a THAAD battery on the peninsula. Right after that, there were no Chinese tourists coming into the country and the cruise ships stopped coming. And they have done similar economic blackmail in other countries that don't go along with their policies. So during the Gulf War and other wars, we're able to get whatever tankers we need off the market. Would we be able to do that in the future? And under the assumption that we won't be able to, and our sources of supply are going to be further away, Transcom initially estimated that we needed 86 tankers overall to support military operations. We have only 6 in international trade, 3 are already in charter to MSC. And the rest of them are in the Jones Act. There are about 40 that could be applied, but you know, how many of those could you take out through the volunteer tanker agreement early enough in order to support military operations before they're backfilled with tankers that we might be able to charter for those operations. So we have a shortfall in tankers. The tanker security program, which has been passed by the House, is an initial attempt to address that, but that's only 10 ships. Admiral Busby says we're 50 ships short of having enough ships out there to provide the crews to maintain the fleet that we have in the reserve, the 46 that he has and 15 at MSC and the reserve fleets. So, you know, that we have to find other ways to grow. Maybe the TSP will grow to a larger number. Another option is Senator Wicker and Congressman Garamendi's Energize American Shipbuilding Act, which would require a percentage of our export crude oil and natural liquefied natural gas to be on U.S. flag and some U.S. built ships. You know, cargo preference is our only other way to generate international trade. And you know, we have under the World Trade Organization followed the rules, and it has not generated through commercial cargo a lot of opportunity for us. So we may have to maintain mandate more cargo preferences in military shipping. Another option that is dear to my heart is that if the U.S. Transportation Command says that we need to maintain shipping in 5-day readiness, rather than the buying foreign hulls or building new ships to lay up, that we would consider resurrecting our marine highways that were basically decimated when the interstate a highway system was built. We had a lot of shipping up and down the coast in the past, but it became much less expensive when the highways got put into play. Now with congestion on highways and the inability to really expand them, we looked at with the Department of Transportation several years ago about military useful privately owned ships that could take 53-foot boxes or trailers off of the interstates and put them on these trailer ships, just like what TOTE does between Washington State and Alaska. And if we had a couple dozen of those ships along the West Coast and some on the East Coast, then you would have the ability to meet some of those military requirements without having to build ships to lay up, which, you know, I did that when I was in the Pentagon. I felt it was a travesty to build a brand new, perfectly good ship and then put it in mothballs, essentially with a small crew. We need to have an active merchant marine. And I think the policy, the National Security Directive that came out in addition to the Merch Marine Act says that we should depend on the active merchant marine to meet our military requirements and only reserve fleets when they can't. I think that we need to do better on figuring out how to build up our national merchant marine, and particularly the Jones Act part of it, because the only way that you can get more ships is to have more cargo. And so I think we need to relook at that effort that was done about 6 years ago, see what the business case analysis is now, given what the cost of trucking is, the cost of rail, and so on. And that could generate another couple of dozen ships initially to help build the merchant marine. So it's either increase your preference cargoes by mandating new legislation, or increasing your stipends like the MSP and the TSP, or doing some type of support to build up your marine highways. I mean, the government provides enormous amount of resources in the highway system. And how much does it provide into the marine highway system? 5 to 10 million a year? No, that's just not fair competition. We really need to build up the marine highways as well.
John, thank you. That's there's certainly several options, and I think you've outlined them quite well in terms of how the American maritime industry can play offense. Sort of starting with the base of the capabilities, the shipbuilding facilities and expertise we have, and the mariner base that we have thanks to the Jones Act, and then building from that.
And then I did mention shipbuilding per se. The small and medium shipyards, as long as the Jones Act is in play, will have enough business to maintain their capability and capacity. And they may be transitioning more from offshore oil to offshore wind, but there still will be opportunities for the Jones Act. And of course, the riverways are still carrying the majority of our bulk cargoes. But of those commercial ships, those four that have been building Jones Act ships in the past, the Jones Act doesn't provide a constant flow. And if it did, it wouldn't be sufficient to maintain four shipyards. We've got 100 ships in the Jones Act and they last 30 years. That gives you three to four ships a year and four shipyards, which each shipyard could build two or three ships a year. We have to have a national shipbuilding policy that coordinates government work, whether it's from the Coast Guard, the Navy, or NOAA, with the Jones Act, and look at it from a national perspective in order to maintain that large shipbuilding industrial base, because those are the shipyards that will be doing battle damage repair for our Navy vessels. They're the ones that build our auxiliaries. They're the ones that we need to maintain and not get into the situation like Canada did in the past. So I didn't highlight the shipbuilding aspect of it, and I wanted to be sure that I gave it its due.
Great, great. We appreciate that. There's a lot in this conversation today, and in the Navy League report to get our heads around. Before we close, is there anything further from the Navy League report that we haven't touched on yet that you would like to point out for our listeners?
No, this report was done because the Navy League, as I mentioned before, sponsors for all four sea services. And we do have an active legislative affairs program and a capability to provide campaigns on various issues, voice to Congress issues, where we contact our members of Congress on areas like the Jones Act, where we want to ensure that it's maintained. So I'd like to encourage people in the audience to go to our Navy League website. They don't even have to be members to go to the legislative affairs section, and if they're and look at the issues that we're currently involved in. Right now, I mean, I already mentioned the Energize American Shipbuilding Act, and we put them up on a regular basis. And certainly if there are other issues that people wish us to be involved in, please let us know, and we will do our best to ensure that the merchant marine that we currently have maintains itself and does what we can to help it grow. And so that's all I would like to say. And certainly if people are not members of the Navy League, I would encourage them to become one, because I think we're one of the very few organizations that really do have a strong advocacy program on Capitol Hill in order to try to ensure that we do keep this industry going.
Well, thank you very much. And we thank the Navy League again for this very important report. And John, we thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me, Mike.
Thank you, John. More to come on this subject for sure. We'll leave it right there for this episode of the American Maritime Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And I would encourage you to share it. You can find the American Maritime Partnership on Twitter @AMP Maritime. This is Mike Roberts signing off.